Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 80, but who's counting? It's Saturday, September 19th. I am recording this show from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio. Welcome to the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. You are listening to locally produced, non-commercial content from WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. Let's get right to it with the local and state update on the status of our COVID-19 epidemic. Here in Lucas County, the daily 7-day average of identified infections went up from 26 last week to a 7-day average of 34 this week. That's a daily average. That's up. Although Lucas County does continue to fare better than Ohio as a whole and the nation as a whole. Similarly, the national trend is back up this last week, as in Lucas County. Ohio seems to be holding fairly steady. It's hard to tell whether it's going to go back up. But at least it's good news for Lucas County that we're doing a little bit better. Now, one thing that is different here in Lucas County versus the state is our testing rates don't seem to be as high. And while our overall rate of identified positives below that of Ohio as a whole, of those tested in Lucas County, the positivity rate over the last week was 8.4%. Over the week before that, it was 10.4%. This compares to the current most recent week of Ohio positivity testing at 3.1%. Public health experts recommend that you get that down below 5%. Which basically indicates that you're probably doing at least enough testing to get some handle on the virus. So statewide, it looks like our overall testing is at a pretty decent level. But in Lucas County, it looks like we're still struggling a bit to offer enough testing to get that overall positivity testing rate down to 5%. But we're at 8.4%, and maybe that's going down. It's hard to tell because the total number of tests isn't reliably regularly reported, but I've looked at it over the last couple of weeks, and we've been around this rate for a while, but hopefully we can get that back down, and Lucas County has offered some pop-up testing in recent weeks. Okay, one thing new this week in the state is that the state is now requiring that schools report positivity among students and staff. In Lucas County, the very first week of reporting, which is just getting rolled out, so it's hard to know how accurate or complete it is, but Lucas County schools had 7 staff that reported positives and only 1 student, although there are reports of more people being isolated, having been exposed. So we'll see how that rolls out in future weeks. That, I would say, probably not bad. Could have expected a lot worse. Okay, the University of Toledo, they're in their 4th week of reporting. They had 38 positives this most recent week, and that's down from each of the 3 previous weeks. Although, given the size of the UT campus community, this is still disproportionately high compared to the number of cases in Lucas County that you'd expect for a similar size population. So they're doing their fair share of spreading a virus, but it looks like there might be some progress. And I would hope that would be the case since contact tracing is run out of University of Toledo for the county. And lastly, nursing homes or long-term care facilities in Lucas County. A couple weeks ago, it bumped up to over 60 active cases, which is we'd been running around 40. But this most recent week, we were down to a low of 17 active cases in nursing homes in Lucas County, and that's the lowest since they've done reporting. They weren't reporting early in the epidemic when the cases might have been higher. But since they started that reporting, I think at the end of April, the beginning of May, this is the lowest that we've had. So that's good news. Okay, well, let's continue with more COVID-19 news. This from The Hill. CDC report, dining out increases risk of contracting coronavirus more than other activities. Dining out is one of the riskiest possible activities during the coronavirus pandemic, according to a report issued by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, citing the fact that masks are not used while people are eating and drinking. CDC officials interviewed about 314 people who experienced symptoms of the virus and got tests, about half of whom were positive. Both the positive and the negative subjects said they had engaged in activities such as attending church and in-person shopping. However, people who tested positive were about twice as likely than those who tested negative to say they had dined at a restaurant. People who tested positive but could not identify a specific occasion when they were exposed to the virus were also more likely to have recently visited a bar or coffee shop. Eating and drinking on-site at locations that offer such options might be important risk factors associated with COVID-19 infection. Efforts to reduce possible exposures where mask use and social distancing are difficult to maintain, such as when eating and drinking, should be considered to protect customers, employees, and communities. I would summarize that by saying avoid in-person dining and support your local restaurant by buying carryout.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me. But the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, next up from The Hill, the CDC director says masks are more guaranteed to work than a vaccine. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Director Dr. Robert Redfield said Wednesday that wearing a mask is more guaranteed to protect someone from the coronavirus than taking a vaccine. Redfield, speaking at a Senate hearing, emphasized the importance of wearing masks, noting that an eventual vaccine is not expected to work in 100% of people and might only work in, say, 70%. But a mask is guaranteed to offer at least some protection for all wearers, he added, though it is far from total protection. We have clear scientific evidence they work. I might even go so far as to say that this face mask, is more guaranteed to protect me against COVID than when I take a COVID vaccine, because the immunogenicity may be 70%, and if I don't get an immune response, the vaccine's not going to protect me. This face mask will, Redfield said. While experts widely say wearing masks is a very important part of the effort to stop the spread of the coronavirus, the development of a vaccine is seen as a key step to getting back to close to pre-COVID-19 normality. These face masks are the most important, powerful public tool we have, and I will continue to appeal for all Americans to embrace those face coverings. If we did it for 6, 8, 10, 12 weeks, we'd bring this pandemic under control, Redfield said. Okay, well, I was glad to hear the CDC director come out so strongly with an endorsement of masks. Of course, that created some confusion with the president, claiming that he was confused. But I want to do a few stories here now talking about kind of the politicization of the CDC, other federal agencies, and the whole public health COVID-19 response. This from Stat News. As controversy swirls, CDC director is seen as allowing agency to buckle to political influence. In his first address to the staff of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Robert Redfield called the Atlanta-based agency the best science-based, data-driven agency in the world. His voice breaking repeatedly as he tried without success to hold back tears, Redfield, named director of the CDC in March 2018, told thousands of employees he had long dreamed of leading the prestigious institution, considered the gold standard for public health agencies around the globe. He made them a solemn vow. "My pledge to you is I will work to continue this legacy," said Redfield, a virologist and physician who specialized in the care of people with HIV. "We're not an opinion organization. We're a science-based, data-driven organization. That's why CDC has the credibility around the world that it has." Now, 2.5 years into his tenure, the storied agency finds itself in a new and treacherous waters. Its reputation stained and the morale of its staff at a historic low, current and former CDC insiders told Stat. Many say Redfield is not doing enough to safeguard the reputation of the CDC and the integrity of its work, and that he is failing to successfully fend off political interference that is eroding America's trust in the organization. "I find it concerning that the CDC director has not been outspoken when there have been instances of clear political interference in the interpretation of science," said Richard Besser, a former acting CDC director and now president of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Former CDC staffers, a number of whom exchanged worried emails bemoaning the state of the agency, are deeply alarmed but wary of speaking out. One former official said current staff are in a quandary over what to do. "Even if you get a dozen of them to resign at one time, it's a one-day story," said the former official. Others were willing to speak publicly. "I think Redfield's not showing the kind of leadership in defense of the institution, in defense of science, I would hope to see," said Mark Rosenberg, who was the first director of CDC's National Center for Injury Prevention and Control. "A reputation that takes 75 years to build can be destroyed in 4 months. That's horrifying," said Rosenberg, who is now retired but remains in touch with former colleagues. Public health experts at the CDC, who led the country's response to countless threats over decades, the deadly emergence of HIV, the anthrax attacks of the autumn of 2001, SARS, the H1N1 flu pandemic, and Ebola, have been sidelined and silenced by the administration in the midst of President Trump's re-election campaign. On multiple occasions, guidance documents written by CDC staff, recommendations that are meant to be the most up-to-date distillation of the emergent science on the SARS-CoV-2 virus, have been revised by political appointees in Washington to reflect administration goals. Guidance to help churches safely resume in-person services in May originally recommended that the use of choirs be suspended or at least decreased due to evidence that choirs have been associated with a number of super-spreading events, including one in Washington State. That advice, however, was removed, according to the Washington Post, which cited objections from Vice President Mike Pence's office. Former CDC Director Tom Friedan, Redfield's immediate predecessor, called the revisions unjustifiable. "It's putting people's lives at risk." Over the summer, according to multiple reports, officials in Washington also intervened to alter guidance on whether or not to reopen schools. That guidance was changed to suggest the CDC felt opening schools was of paramount importance, regardless of whether doing so would spread COVID-19. "They worked on the school guidelines for months," Rosenberg said of the CDC staff. "Around the clock, 24/7, they were working to get the best scientific guidance for the country." And then the White House stuck an introduction in the front of it on the CDC website that said, "The most important thing is for kids to go back to school." That wasn't written by CDC. That wasn't anything CDC people wanted to say. Most recently, guidance on who to test for COVID-19 has changed to recommend against the testing of people who have been in contact with cases but were asymptomatic. In fact, finding people as soon as possible so they can be told to isolate is the key to containing spread of the virus. "This is fundamental misunderstanding of what public health is," Friedan said. The testing advice change led to an extraordinary publication of an op-ed in the New York Times late last month urging public health officials around the country to, quote, ignore the CDC. It was written by Harold Varmus, a former director of the National Institutes of Health, and Rajiv Shah, president of the Rockefeller Foundation. Now, I would like to editorially add that in the last 24 hours, the CDC has reversed itself with all that kind of pressure. Okay, back to the story. In recent days, first Politico and then other news organizations have reported that officials in Washington have been attempting to revise or delay the publication of scientific reports in the CDC's online journal Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. MMWR, as it's better known, is a bedrock of public health. It is where the first reports of AIDS cases in the United States were published. It is where public health workers seek the latest on an outbreak or a disease first turn. Michael Caputo, Director of Communications for the Department of Health and Human Services, and his scientific advisor Paul Alexander, a sometimes part-time university lecturer with McMaster University in Canada, had reportedly been demanding to read and change MMWR articles before they were published. Caputo has denied having read MMWR articles before publication. On Wednesday, HHS announced that Caputo, who alleged on Facebook last weekend that CDC scientists were engaged in, quote, sedition, was taking a 60-day medical leave, and Alexander, the scientific advisor, was leaving the department. The CDC declined to make Redfield available for an interview, but invited written questions for this story. In a written response, the CDC director sidestepped all of Stat's questions about political influence on guidance documents, revisions of MMWR articles, and his own pledge to safeguard the agency's reputation. Instead, he said he believes the CDC, quote, remains the world's premier public health agency. I believe without question the CDC science, data, and service have had a tremendous impact on saving human life in the pandemic, Redfield wrote. When asked Wednesday during congressional testimony about political interference in MMWR, Redfield said it had not happened. At no time was the scientific integrity of the MMWR been compromised, and I can say that under my watch it will not be compromised, he told Senator Patty Murray, Democrat of Washington. Redfield, a deeply religious man, he often ends his interview by saying, God bless, is described by many as earnest and kind. Caputo called the director one of my closest friends in Washington in a statement issued to the New York Times. But sources tell Stat that Redfield is not a good listener. This is a shortcoming he seems aware of. In his March 2018 address to the CDC staff, he said his wife Joy had given him a to-do list for his new job. Quote, the first one was, listen. The second one was, don't interrupt. The third one was, listen. Redfield did not come to the CDC with a background in public health, and he struggles as a communicator, eroding his ability to advocate for the CDC's positions, a number of sources suggested. At meetings of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, he is said to frequently defer to the more assertive Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Though he has stepped into the breach left by the CDC director, Fauci is not a trained public health expert either. Like Redfield, he is a virologist and an HIV clinician. Besser acknowledged he doesn't know if or how hard Redfield fights for the CDC behind closed doors. Friedan noted it has been reported the CDC director pushed back on the issue of the MMWR. But Redfield's lack of public defense of the agency he was so eager to lead is deeply concerning to CDC staff and alumni. The CDC director, and this goes for anyone in leadership, has to look inside themselves and say, there is a line that I will not cross, and there's a line that I will not allow others to cross if it undercuts the value of the agency, Besser said. And time again in this pandemic, we've seen political actions that have undermined the credibility of the CDC, undermined the trust of the public in the CDC, and we have not been seeing a forceful defense of that by the CDC director. What we're seeing now is an erosion of that trust, he said. That's detrimental and will cost lives. Okay, well, this next story is also from Stat News. Top health official echoes Trump's COVID-19 views, drawing accusations of politicizing U.S. mental health agency. Reopen the schools, diminish the seriousness of the coronavirus pandemic, and the economy comes first. President Trump and White House aides have been pushing these views for months. Now a top public health official is joining the chorus. In a new podcast and in other public statements, the head of the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, SAMHSA, strongly echoes the president's talking points on reopening schools and businesses, angering current and former agency officials who say she is politicizing the office and reinforcing administration arguments about COVID-19 that aren't supported by sound scientific evidence. What is this nonsense that somehow it's unsafe to return to school, SAMHSA Administrator Eleanor McCants-Katz says, unprompted, midway through a podcast posted last week on the website of the Department of Health and Human Services. At another point, she says, there was no agreement to this nonstop restriction and quarantining and isolation and taking away anything that makes people happy. You can't go to a movie, you can't go to a football game. A psychiatrist with a PhD in infectious disease epidemiology from Yale, McCants-Katz argues during the podcast that the harsh steps taken to contain the pandemic in the spring were excessive. I'm going to say it, she said. We shut down the entire country before the virus, in my opinion, had a chance to get around the entire country. We use a sledgehammer when I think we needed a scalpel. Even with the administration in an administration where political appointees atop health agencies are expected to stand behind the president's handling of the COVID-19 crisis, former agency officials were taken aback by her comments. Regina LaBelle, chief of staff of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy during the Obama administration, said when she heard the last line of the podcast, quote, paid for by taxpayers, she started laughing. It's so blatantly political and cynical, and it breaks my heart to see this, says LaBelle, now program director of the Addiction and Public Policy Initiative at the Georgetown University Law Center. Families are suffering, and they deserve to be treated with respect by their government. I've always had great respect for her, LaBelle said of McCants-Katz, but as a political appointee, she's in a bubble of the machinery of government, and right now, the machinery of government is being used to re-elect the president. The podcast is part of a series in which Michael Caputo, a former Trump campaign official, appointed as HHS Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs in April, interviews department officials. Caputo has become a controversial figure at HHS. His communications team has been pressuring the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to water down weekly scientific reports on COVID-19 to more closely align with the president's optimistic views about the course of the pandemic, Politico reported last week. And over the weekend, according to the New York Times, Caputo claimed on Facebook without evidence that government scientists were engaging in sedition and that left-wing hit squads were preparing for armed insurrection after the election. The podcasts are posted on the HHS website and distributed through popular platforms including Apple, Google Play, and Spotify. Each episode takes a listener behind the scenes at HHS as the experts explain what they're working on and what you need to know, an HHS spokesman said. In the latest podcast, McCants-Katz says reopening schools and businesses is essential for people's mental health. There was a study published just a few months ago that said for every 1% increase in unemployment, we will see an additional 1.3% jump in our suicide, she says. So this is going to be a hugely terrible but important issue for us to address. Caputo tells McCants-Katz that the opposition to reopening schools is political, to which he responds, it makes no sense. McCants-Katz, appointed to lead SAMHSA by Trump in 2017, never once challenges Caputo in the podcast, not even when Caputo, the top communications official at HHS, says, I don't think the United States media gives a damn about public health information. I don't too, McCants-Katz responds. Bob Lubran, until the end of 2016, the head of SAMHSA's Division of Pharmacologic Therapies, said he believes McCants-Katz is being pressured to make such comments. I view that as taking the party line, he said. I can't imagine she would volunteer to do that. Another former agency employee who knew McCants-Katz well as was Blunter, saying she drank the Kool-Aid. Like many former and current officials interviewed for this article, this person didn't want to be identified, fearing retaliation. McCants-Katz did not respond to an email request for comment, nor did spokespersons for SAMHSA and HHS. SAMHSA leads public health efforts to reduce substance abuse and mental illness. McCants-Katz was its first chief medical officer during the Obama administration, but left afterward writing a scathing letter to Psychiatric Times in which she criticized the agency for not caring adequately for people with serious mental illness. She was brought back by President Trump as Assistant Secretary for Mental Health and Substance Use at HHS at the beginning of his term. There have been other instances in which McCants-Katz has aligned herself with Trump's view in response to the COVID-19. In mid-August, she wrote an op-ed in USA Today calling for schools to reopen. She cited the American Academy of Pediatrics policy, which urged the return of children to classrooms, but she did not mention their caveat that the reopening proceed only if it could be done safely. While the data shows clearly, what the data shows clearly is that when schools reopen and community spread has not been adequately controlled, you will have infection in kids and teachers and parents. Nathaniel Beers, a pediatrician who serves at the American Academy of Pediatrics spokesman and on its Council of School Health. Children are part of a social network, said H. Wesley Clark, former director of SAMHSA's Center for Substance Abuse Treatment, citing a CDC study that found children infected with the coronavirus at childcare facilities had transmitted it to household members. We have to ask how a child would feel if he or she infects his or her parent, especially if that parent is incapacitated by SARS-CoV-2 brought home by the child, added Clark, a psychiatrist who is now a dean's executive professor at Santa Clara University. Remember, community of colors have been disproportionately affected by COVID-19. McCants Katz also told President Trump during a May 19th cabinet meeting that it's vital to reopen the economy. To put all this in perspective, I believe it is important to point out that pre-pandemic, we lose 120,000 lives a year to drug overdoses and suicide. How many more lives are we willing to sacrifice in the name of containing the virus, she said. At the time, there had been more than 90,000 COVID-19 deaths reported in the U.S. in just 3 months, and the total is now 200,000. When we look at strategies to reopen, as a medical director, I ask that you take into account whole health, not just one narrow aspect of physical health, said McCann-Katz at the White House meeting. We continually ask ourselves what the health costs and risks may be of reopening, but I ask, what might they be of not reopening or reopening in such a restrictive way that American lives are not restored? As a psychiatrist, I would argue that a life lost to suicide is just as important as a life lost to coronavirus, she concluded, calling the virus only, quote, one metric, and adding, virus containment cannot be our only goal, no matter the cost to Americans. McCants-Katz made no mention of the fact that lockdowns were deemed necessary to public health officials to flatten the curve in the spring and keep the U.S. healthcare system from being overwhelmed. Yes, overdoses are increasing and suicide is increasing, probably related to a lot of the things, including coronavirus, one former SAMHSA employee told Stat. Probably everybody in the United States has some form of generalized anxiety disorder right now, but is it ethical to say that we will reduce the suicide and overdose rates by reopening? We don't know what we don't know. It's bad logic. Stat interviewed 6 former senior SAMHSA officials for this article, 3 other former high-level federal officials, and 7 agency contractors and grantees, and most didn't want their names used, citing fears that they could be retaliated against. Former officials said they feared their current employers risk losing agency funding if they spoke openly. As a former SAMHSA employee, one person said, I have seen the vindictiveness of this administration and McCants-Katz's hench people firsthand towards those who challenge the status quo, and I can't afford to put my organization in the line of fire.
And now a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you, your friends and loved ones, your city, state, your entire nation, suffer from an unprecedented crisis? Then your body politic may be infected with TLTL 2020 virus, also known as the TL20 squared virus. This too little too late 2020 virus has many vague and contradicting symptoms, but it is known to be exacerbated by election years. Do you suffer from exponential anxiety, worldwide depression, and recurring hallucinations of unimpeachable leadership? Don't worry, as the 2020 campaign season heats up, this will all go away. We don't call it a novelty virus for nothing. Hey people, don't look down. Things are looking up. Body bag futures are looking fantastic. This promises to be the best pandemic ever. Incredible things will happen as you save the world by doing nothing but watching TV. But remember, only get your Nothing Burgers from the drive-thru window. Please note, Nothing Burgers will now be referred to as Patriot Burgers. Doing too little has never been easier. Hey, what's the worst? That could happen. This message is brought to you by Cassandra Reproductions, seer of unbelievable futures, and maker of Pickled Posterity, coming too little, too late, to a shuttered store near you. You may now return to your regular programming.
Okay, in an atmosphere of politicization of public health, we have this next story from The Hill. Polls show trust in scientific political institutions eroding. The American public is beginning to lose trust in political leaders and scientific institutions. As the coronavirus pandemic drags into its 6th month, troubling signs that raise the prospect that millions of Americans may not take advice or get a vaccine once one becomes available. Two new surveys show most Americans still trust leading scientists and institutions, like the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, but that those levels of trust are beginning to erode. Nearly 8 in 10 Americans trust the CDC, according to a survey conducted by the COVID-19 Consortium for Understanding the Public Policy Preferences Across States, a group of researchers at Northeastern University, Harvard, Rutgers, and Northwestern University. That figure is down from 87% who said they trusted the Atlanta-based CDC in April. A poll conducted by the Kaiser Family Foundation found 67% of Americans had a great deal or a fair amount of trust in the CDC to provide reliable information about the coronavirus. That number has dropped 16 percentage points since April. Trust in the CDC among Republicans has dropped a whopping 30 percentage points. The consortium poll found fewer than half, 47%, trust the news media, while just 43% say they trust President Trump and only 42% trust Congress. Those numbers have all declined precipitously from the spring, when most Americans rallied to their leaders as a crisis began to unfold. I don't think anyone is thrilled with the status quo. It's been a disappointment as a general proposition, said David Laser, a political scientist at Northeastern and one of the study's authors. About half of Americans say they have a great deal or some level of trust in Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden, the poll found. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert, is still viewed as the most trusted individual to deliver information about the virus, according to both surveys. But a stark partisan divide has emerged. Democrats are now more likely to say they trust Fauci's advice, but his image among Republicans has dropped 29 points. The CDC and Dr. Anthony Fauci are still the top trusted officials for information about COVID, said Liz Hamel, who directs public opinion research for the Kaiser Family Foundation. We see increasing political polarization in how people think about these two sources. Across states, residents have responded most strongly to governors who acted quickly and early to combat the virus. More than three-quarters of Vermont residents approve the way Governor Phil Scott, Republican, has handled their pandemic, a higher rating than any governor in the nation. Governors in Connecticut, Delaware, Massachusetts, Maryland, Michigan, New Hampshire, New Jersey, New York, and Rhode Island all have approval ratings north of 60%. At the same time, governors who race to reopen their economies suffer from some of the worst approval ratings. Just 30% of Arizona residents like what they have seen from Governor Doug Ducey, Republican, who waited months before allowing cities to impose mask mandates. Only 29% approve of the way Governor Ron DeSantis, Republican, has handled the situation in Florida. In Iowa, which is suffering the worst major outbreak on a per capita basis in the United States, just 26% approve of the job Governor Kim Reynolds, Republican, has offered. Only 31% approve of Hawaii Governor David Ige's Democrat handling of the outbreak. In a recent interview, Senator Brian Schatz, Democrat from Hawaii, called his state's handling of the pandemic, quote, objectively terrible. Trust in institutions will become an urgent necessity if and when a potential vaccine is found to be safe and effective, experts said. If Americans do not trust those who tell them a vaccine is safe, they will be less likely to accept it, prolonging a pandemic that might otherwise be brought under control. Part of the reason why trust is important is that a lot of what we need to combat the pandemic is voluntary cooperation of citizens. One of the places you need trust is someone saying, trust me, inject this into your body. That requires trust that there has been due diligence to check that this has been safe and effective. Just 53% of Americans said they would be somewhat or extremely likely to get a vaccine, a 7-point decline in the space of only a month, according to the consortium study. Most Americans, 62%, told Kaiser pollsters they worry the Food and Drug Administration would rush a vaccine without making sure it is safe and effective. There has been vaccine skepticism among both Democrats, who do not trust President Trump not to meddle with the science, and Republicans, some of whom question the very existence of a pandemic that has claimed the lives of about 200,000 Americans. Republicans in general are not perceiving the coronavirus as a big risk, Hamel said. Misinformation about the coronavirus and ways to protect against it continue to spread as well. More than half of Republicans incorrectly believe hydroxychloroquine, a drug often touted by Trump, is an effective treatment, despite scientific studies that show it is not. More than a third of Republicans believe wearing a face mask is harmful to one's health, which it is not. Okay, well, next up I've got a long but excellent article from The Atlantic. that really gets at kind of the conundrum that we're in as a nation trying to deal with this pandemic. This is entitled, America is Trapped in a Pandemic Spiral. Army ants will sometimes walk in circles until they die. The workers navigate by smelling the pheromone trails of workers in front of them, while laying down pheromones for others to follow. If these trails accidentally loop back on themselves, the ants are trapped. They become a thick, swirling vortex of bodies that resembles a hurricane as viewed from space. They march endlessly until they're felled by exhaustion or dehydration. The ants can sense no bigger picture than what's immediately ahead. They have no coordinating force to guide them to safety. They are imprisoned by a wall of their own instincts. This phenomenon is called the death spiral. I can think of no better metaphor for the United States of America's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. The U.S. enters the ninth month of the pandemic with more than 6.3 million confirmed cases and more than 200,000 confirmed deaths. The toll has been enormous because the country presented the SARS-CoV coronavirus with a smorgasbord of vulnerabilities to exploit. But the toll continues to be enormous. Every day, the case count rises by around 40,000 and the death toll by around 800 because the country has consistently thought about the pandemic in the same unproductive ways. Many Americans trusted intuition to help guide them through this disaster. They grabbed onto whatever solution was most prominent in the moment and bounced from one, often false hope, to the next. They saw the actions that individual people were taking and blamed and shamed their neighbors. They lapsed into magical thinking and believed that the world would return to normal within months. Following these impulses was simpler than navigating a web of solutions, staring down broken systems, and accepting that the pandemic would rage for at least a year. These conceptual errors were not egregious lies or conspiracy theories, but they were still dangerous. They manifested again and again, distorting the debate around whether to stay at home, wear masks, or open colleges. They prevented citizens from grasping the scope of the crisis and pushed leaders toward bad policies. And instead of overriding misleading intuitions with calm and considered communications, those leaders intensified them. The country is now trapped in an intuition nightmare. Like the spiraling ants, Americans are walled in by their own unhelpful instincts, which lead them round and round in self-destructive circles. The grand challenge now is how can we adjust our thinking to match the problem before us, says Lori Peek, a sociologist at the University of Colorado at Boulder, who studies disasters. Here, then, are nine errors of intuition that still hamstring the United States pandemic response and a glimpse at the future if they continue unchecked. The time to break free is now. Our pandemic summer is nearly over. Now come fall, the season of preparation, and winter, the season of survival. The U.S. must reset its mindset to accomplish both. Ant death spirals break only when enough workers accidentally blunder away, creating trails that lead the spiraling workers to safety. But humans don't have to rely on luck. Unlike ants, we have the capacity for introspection. The spiral begins when people forget that controlling the pandemic means doing many things at once. The virus can spread before symptoms appear and does so most easily through five P's, people in prolonged, poorly ventilated, protection-free proximity. There's a new one. To stop the spread, this country could use measures that other nations did to great effect. Close non-essential businesses and spaces that allow crowds to congregate indoors, improve ventilation, encourage mask use, test widely to identify contagious people, trace their contacts, help them isolate themselves, and provide a social safety net so that people can protect others without sacrificing their livelihood. None of these other nations did everything, but all did enough things right and did them simultaneously. By contrast, the U.S. engaged in, okay, and here's the long trek of nine problems that we've run into. Number one, a serial monogamy of solutions. Stay-at-order homes dominated March. Masks were fiercely debated in April. Contact tracing took its turn in May. Ventilation is having its moment. Now it's like we only have attention for only one thing at a time, says Natalie Dean, a biostatistician at the University of Florida. As often happens, people sought easy technological fixes for complex societal problems. For months, President Donald Trump touted hydroxychloroquine as a COVID-19 cure, even as rigorous studies showed that it isn't one. In August, he switched his attention to convalescent plasma, the liquid fraction of a COVID-19 survivor's blood that might contain virus-blocking antibodies. There's still no clear evidence that this century-old approach can treat COVID-19 either, despite grossly misstated claims from FDA Commissioner Stephen Heim, for which he later apologized. More generally, drugs might save some of the very sickest patients, as dexamethasone does, or shorten a hospital stay, as remdesivir does, but they are unlikely to offer outright cures. It's so reassuring to think that a magic bullet treatment is out there, and if we just wait, it'll come and things will be normal, Dean says. Other strategies have merit but are wrongly dismissed for being imperfect. In July, Carl Bergstrom, an epidemiologist and sociologist of science at the University of Washington, argued that colleges can't reopen safely without testing all students upon entry. The gotcha question I've handled most from reporters since then is, this school did entry testing, so why did they get an outbreak, he says. It's because such testing is necessary for a safe reopening, but not sufficient. If you do it and screw everything else up, you still have a big outbreak, Bergstrom adds. This brief attention span is understandable. Adherents of the scientific method are trained to isolate and change one variable at a time. Academics are walled off into different disciplines that rarely connect. Journalists constantly look for new stories, shifting attention to the next great idea. These factors prime the public to view solutions in isolation, which means imperfections become conflated with uselessness. For example, many critics of masks argue that they provide only partial protection against the virus, that they often don't fit well, or that people wear them incorrectly. But some protection is clearly better than no protection. As Dylan Morris of Princeton writes, X won't stop COVID on its own is not an argument against doing X. Instead, it's an argument for doing X along with other measures. Seatbelts won't prevent all fatal car crashes, but cars also come with airbags and crumple zones. Whenever we layer things, we give ourselves more wiggle room, Dean says. Several experts I've talked to have been asked, what now? The question assumes that the pandemic lingers because the U.S. simply hasn't found the right solution yet. In fact, it lingers because the familiar solutions were never fully implemented. Despite claims from the White House, the U.S. is still not testing enough people. It still doesn't have enough contact tracers. We have the playbook, but I think there's a confusion about what we've actually tried and what we've just talked about doing, Dean says. A successful response is never going to be one thing done perfectly. It'll be a lot of different things done well. That resilience disappears if we create, number two, false dichotomies. A world of black and white is easier to handle than one awash with grays, but false dichotomies are dangerous. From the start, COVID-19 has been portrayed as a disease that mostly causes mild symptoms in people who recover quickly, and occasionally causes severe illness that leads to hospitalization and death. This two-sided caricature, severe or mild, sick or recovered, has erased the thousands of long haulers who have endured months of debilitating symptoms at home with neither recognition nor care. Meanwhile, as businesses closed and stay-at-home orders rolled out, we presumed a trade-off between saving lives and saving the economy, says Daniel Allen, a political scientist at Harvard. That was foolishness of the most profound degree. The two goals were actually aligned. Epidemiologists and economists largely agree that the economy cannot rebound while the pandemic is still raging. By treating the two as opposites, state leaders rushed to reopen, leading a barely contained virus to surge anew. Now, as winter looms and the pandemic continues, another dichotomy has emerged. Enter another awful lockdown or let the virus run free. This choice, too, is false. Public health measures offer a middle road, and even lockdowns need not be as overbearing as they were in the spring. A city could close higher-risk venues like bars and nightclubs while opening lower-risk ones like retail stores. There's a whole control panel of dials and on offer, but it's hard to have that conversation when people think of a light switch, said Lindsay Wiley, professor of public health law at American University. The term lockdown has done a lot of damage. It exacerbated the false binary between shutting down and opening up, while offering, number three, the comfort of theatricality. Stay-at-home orders save lives by curtailing COVID's spread and by giving hospitals some breathing room, but the orders were also meant to buy time for the nation to ramp up its public health defenses. Instead, the White House treated months of physical distancing as a pandemic-ending strategy in itself. We squandered that that time in terms of scaling up testing and contact tracing, enacting policies to protect workers who get infected on the job, getting protective equipment to people in food processing plants, finding places for people to isolate, offering paid sick leave. We still don't have those things, said Julia Marcus, an infectious disease epidemiologist at Harvard Medical School and a regular Atlantic contributor. The country is now facing the fall with many of the same problems that plagued it through the summer. Showiness is often mistaken for effectiveness. The coronavirus mostly spreads through air rather than contaminated surfaces, but many businesses are nonetheless trying to scrub and bleach their way toward reopening. My colleague Derek Thompson calls this hygiene theater, dramatic moves that appear to offer safety without actually doing so. The same charge applies to temperature checks, which can't detect the many COVID-19 patients who don't have a fever. It also applies to the porous and inefficient travel bans that Trump and his allies still tout as policy successes. These tactics might do some good, let's not conflate imperfect with useless, but they cause harm when they substitute for stronger measures. Theatricality breeds complacency, and by emphasizing solutions that can be easily seen, it exacerbated the American preference for, get ready, number four, personal blame over systemic fixes. SARS-CoV-2 spread rapidly among America's overstuffed prisons and understaffed nursing homes, in communities served by overstretched hospitals and underfunded public health departments, and among Black, Latino, and Indigenous Americans who have been geographically and financially disconnected from healthcare by decades of racist policies. Without paid sick leave or a living wage, quote, essential workers who earned a low hourly income could not afford to quarantine themselves when they fell ill, especially not if they would jeopardize the jobs to which their health care is tied. The thing I do to stay safe, they don't have that option, says Whitney Robinson, social epidemiologist at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. But tattered social safety nets are less visible than crowded bars. Pushing for universal health care is harder than shaming an unmasked stranger. Fixing systemic problems is more difficult than spewing moralism, and Americans gravitated towards the latter. News outlets illustrated pandemic articles with, often distorted, photos of beaches, even though open-air spaces offer low-risk ways for people to enjoy themselves. Marcus attributes this tendency to America's puritanical roots, which conflate pleasure with irresponsibility, and which prize shame over support. The shaming gets codified into bad policy, she says. Chicago fenced off a beach, and Honolulu closed beaches, parks, and hiking trails, while leaving riskier indoor businesses open. Moralistic thinking jeopardizes health in two ways. First, people often oppose measures that reduce an individual's risk, seatbelts, condoms, HPV vaccines, because such protections might promote risky behavior. During the pandemic, some experts used such reasoning to question the value of masks, while the University of Michigan president argued that testing students widely would offer, quote, a false sense of security. These paternalistic false assurance arguments are almost always false themselves. There's very little evidence for overcompensation to the point where safety measures do harm, Bergstrom says. Second, misplaced moralism can provide cover for bad policies. Many colleges started their semester with in-person teaching and inadequate testing and are predictably dealing with large outbreaks. UNC Chapel Hill lasted just 6 days before reverting to remote classes. Administrators have chastised students for behaving irresponsibly while taking no responsibility for setting them up to fail, a pattern that will likely continue through the fall as college clusters inevitably grow. If you put 10,000 students in a small space, eating, sleeping, and socializing together, there'll be an explosion of cases, Robinson says. I don't know what colleges were expecting. Perhaps they fell prey to, here it is, number five, the normality trap. In times of uncertainty and upheaval, people crave a return to familiar, predictable rhythms, says Monica Shokspana, a medical anthropologist at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. That pull is especially strong now because the pandemic's toll is largely invisible. There's nothing as dramatic as ruined buildings or lapping floodwater to hint that the world has changed. In some circles, returning to normal has been valorized as an act of defiance. That's a reasonable stance when resisting terrorists who seek to stoke fear, but a dangerous one when fighting a virus which doesn't care. The powerful desire to recreate an old world can obscure the trade-offs necessary for surviving the new one. Keeping a high-risk indoor businesses open, for example, helps the virus spread within a community, which makes reopening schools harder. If schools are a priority, but have to put them ahead of something, what is that something, said Bill Hannage, an epidemiologist at Harvard, In an ideal world, they would be the last to close and the first to open. But in many communities, casinos, bars, and tattoo parlors open before them. A world with COVID-19 is fundamentally different from one without it. And the former simply cannot include all the trappings of the latter. Cherished summer rituals like camps and baseball games have already been lost. Back-to-school traditions and Thanksgiving now hang in the balance. Change is hard to accept, which predisposes people to... Number 6, magical thinking. Back in April, Trump imagined the pandemic's quick end. Maybe this goes away with heat and light, he said. From the start, he and others wondered if hot, humid weather might curb the spread of COVID-19 as it does other coronavirus diseases. Many experts countered that seasonal effects wouldn't stop the new virus, which was already spreading in the tropics. But fueled by shaky science and speculative stories, people widely latched onto seasonality as a possible savior before the virus proved that it could thrive in the Arizona, Texas, and Florida summer. This brand of magical thinking, in which some factor naturally diffuses the pandemic, has become a convenient excuse for inaction. Recently, some commentators have argued that the pandemic will immediately fizzle out for two reasons. First, 20 to 50% of people have defensive T cells that recognize the new coronavirus because they were previously exposed to its mild or common cold-causing cousins. Second, some modeling studies claim that herd immunity, whereby the virus struggles to find new hosts because enough people are immune, could kick in with just 20% of the population has been infected. Neither claim is implausible, but neither should be grounds for complacency. No one yet knows if the cross-reactive T cells actually protect against COVID-19, and even if they do, they're unlikely to stop people from getting infected. Herd immunity, meanwhile, is not a perfect barrier. Even if the low thresholds were correct, a fast-growing and uncontrolled outbreak will still shoot past them. Pursuing this strategy will mean that, in the winter, many parts of the U.S. may suffer what New York City endured in the spring, thousands of deaths and an untold number of lingering disabilities. That alone should be an argument against, number 7, the complacency of inexperience. When illness is averted and lives are spared, nothing happens, and all you have is the miracle of a normal, healthy day, says Howard Koh, a public health professor at Harvard. People take that for granted. Public health departments are chronically underfunded because the suffering they prevent is invisible. Pandemic preparations are deprioritized in the peaceful years between outbreaks. Even now, many people who have been spared the ravages of COVID-19 argue that the disease wasn't a big deal, or associate their woes with preventive measures. But the problem is still the disease that measures prevented. The economy is still hurting, mental health problems are growing, and educational futures have been curtailed, not because of some fear-mongering overreaction, but because of an uncontrolled pandemic is still afoot. If anything, the U.S. did not react swiftly or strongly enough. Nations that had previously dealt with emerging viral pandemics, including several in East Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa, were quick to take the new coronavirus seriously. By contrast, America's lack of similar first-hand experience, combined with its sense of exceptionalism, might have contributed to its initial sloppiness. One of my colleagues went to Rwanda in February, and as soon as he hit the airport, they asked about symptoms, checked his temperature, and took his phone number, says Abrar Karan, an internist at Brigham and Women's Hospital at Harvard Medical School. In the U.S., I flew in July and walked out of the airport. No questions asked. Even when the virus began spreading within the U.S., places that weren't initially pummeled seemed to forget that viruses spread. In April, I was seeing COVID patients in the ER every day. In Texas, I had friends saying, no one believes it here because we have no cases. In L.A., fellow physicians are you sure this is worse than the flu? We're not seeing anything. 3 months later, Texas and California saw COVID-19 all too closely. The tendency to ignore threats until they directly affect us has consigned the U.S. to, number 8, a reactive rut. In March, Mike Ryan at the World Health Organization advised, be fast, have no regrets, the virus will always get you if you don't move quickly. The U.S. failed to heed that warning and has repeatedly found itself steps behind the coronavirus. That's partly because exponential growth is counterintuitive, so we don't understand that things look fine until right before they're not very fine, says Beth Redbird, a sociologist at Northwestern. It's also because the coronavirus spreads quickly, but is slow to reveal itself. It can take a month for infections to lead to symptoms, for symptoms to warrant tests and hospitalizations, and for enough sick people to produce a noticeable spike. Pandemic data are like the light of distant stars recording past events instead of present ones. This lag separates actions from their consequences by enough time to break our intuition for cause and effect. Policymakers end up acting only when it's too late. Predictable surges get falsely cast as unexpected surprises. This reactive rut also precludes long-term planning. In April, Michael Osterholm, an epidemiologist at the University of Minnesota, told me that people haven't understood that the pandemic isn't about the next couple of weeks, but about the next 2 years. Leaders should have taken the long view then. We should have been thinking about what it would take to ensure schools open in the fall and prevent the long-term harms of lost children's development. Instead, we started working our way through a serial monogamy of solutions and, like spiraling army ants, marched forward with no sense of future beyond the next few footsteps. These errors crop up in all disasters, but the COVID-19 pandemic has special qualities that have exacerbated them. The virus moved quickly enough to upend the status quo in a few months, deepening the allure of the hastily abandoned past. It also moved slowly enough to sweep the U.S. in a patchwork fashion, allowing as yet untouched communities to drop their guard. The pandemic grew huge in scope, entangling every aspect of society and maxing out our capacity to deal with complexity. People struggle to make rational decisions when they cannot see all the cogs, said Njoki Marumba, an emergency management professor at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. Full of fear and anxiety, people furiously search for more information, but because the virus is so new, they instead spiraled into more confusion and uncertainty. And tragically, all this happened during the presidency of Donald Trump. Trump embodied and amplified America's intuition death spiral. Instead of rolling out a detailed, coordinated plan to control the pandemic, he ricocheted from one overhyped cure-all to another, while relying on theatrics such as travel bans. He ignored inequities and systemic failures in favor of blaming China, the World Health Organization, governors, Anthony Fauci, and Barack Obama. He widened the false dichotomy between lockdowns and reopening by regularly tweeting in favor of the latter. He and his allies appealed to magical thinking and steered the U.S. straight into the normality trap by frequently lying that the virus would go away and that the pandemic was ending, that new waves weren't happening, and that rising case numbers were solely due to increased testing. We have started talking about COVID-19 in the past tense as cases surge in the Midwest. It's like mass gaslighting, said Martha Lincoln, a medical anthropologist at San Francisco State University. We were put in a situation where better solutions were closed off, but a lot of people had that fact sneak up on them. In the absence of a robust federal response, we're all left washing our hands and hoping for the best, which makes us more susceptible to magical thinking and individual level fixes. And if those fixes never come, I think people are going to harden into fatalistic sense that we have to accept whatever the risks are to continue with our everyday lives. That might indeed be Trump's next solution. The Washington Post reports that Trump's new advisor, the neuroradiologist Scott Atlas, is pushing a strategy that lets the virus rip through the non-elderly population in a bid to reach herd immunity. This policy was folly for Sweden, which is nowhere near herd immunity, had one of the world's highest COVID-19 death rates, and has a regretful state epidemiologist. Although the White House has denied that a formal herd immunity policy exists, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recently changed its guidance to say that asymptomatic people, quote, do not necessarily need a test, even after close contact with an infected person. This change makes no sense. People can still spread the virus before showing symptoms. By effectively recommending less testing, as Trump has specifically called for, the nation's top public health agency is depriving the U.S. of data it needs to resist intuitive errors. When there's a refusal to take in the big picture, we are stuck. The pandemic is now in its ninth month. Uncertainties abound as fall and winter loom. In much of the country, colder weather will gradually pack people into indoor spaces where the coronavirus more readily spreads. Winter also typically heralds the arrival of the flu and other respiratory viruses. And although the Southern Hemisphere enjoyed an unusually mild flu season, that is because of the severe precautions they were taking against COVID-19, says Eleanor Murray, an epidemiologist at Boston University. It's not clear to me that our precautions will be successful enough to also prevent the flu. Schools are reopening, which will shape the path of the pandemic in still uncertain ways. Universities are more predictable. Thanks to magical thinking and misplaced moralism, the U.S. already has at least 51,000 confirmed infections in more than 1,000 colleges across every state. These underestimated numbers will grow because only 20% of colleges are doing regular testing, while almost half are not testing at all. As more are forced to stop in-person teaching, students will be sent back to their communities with COVID-19 in tow. I expect this will blow up outbreaks in places that never had outbreaks, or in places that had outbreaks under control, Murray says. Further spikes will likely occur after Thanksgiving and Christmas, as people who yearn to return to normal or think that the country has overreacted travel to see their family. Despite that risk, the CDC recently dropped its recommendation that out-of-state travelers should quarantine themselves for 14 days. But many of the experts I spoke with thought it unlikely that we'll have cities going full New York, as Bergstrom puts it. Doctors are getting better at treating the disease. States like Massachusetts, New York, and New Jersey have managed to avoid new surges over the summer, showing that local leadership can at least partly compensate for federal laxity. A new generation of cheap, rapid, paper-based tests will hit the market and make it easier to work out who is contagious. And despite the spiral of bad intuition, many Americans are holding the line. Mask use and support for physical distancing are still high, according to Redbert, who has been tracking pandemic-related attitudes since March. My feeling is that while things are going to get worse, I'm not sure they'll be catastrophic because of situational awareness. Meanwhile, Trump seems to be teeing up a vaccine announcement in late October, shortly before the November 3rd election. Monsef Slaoui, the scientific head of Operation Warp Speed, told NPR that it's extremely unlikely a vaccine will be ready by then, and many scientists are concerned that the FDA will be pressured into approving a product that hasn't been adequately tested, as Russia and China already have. Many Americans share this concern. A safe and effective vaccine could finally bring the pandemic under control, but its arrival will also test America's ability to resist the intuitive errors that have trapped it so far. Vaccination has long been portrayed as the ultimate biomedical silver bullet, separating an era when masks and social distancing mattered from a world where normality has returned. This is yet another false dichotomy. Everyone's imagining this moment when all of a sudden it's all over and I can go on vacation, Natalie Dean says, but the reality is going to be messier. This problem is not unique to COVID-19. It's more compelling to hope that drug-resistant bacteria can be beaten with viruses than to stem the overuse of antibiotics, to hack the climate than to curb greenhouse gas emissions, or to invest in a doomed oceanic plastic catcher than to reduce the production of waste. Throughout its entire history, and more than any other nation, the U.S. has espoused an almost blind faith in the power of technology as panacea, writes historian Howard Siegel. Instead of solving social problems, the U.S. uses techno fixes to bypass them, plastering the wounds instead of removing the source of injury. And that's if people even accept the solution on offer. A third of Americans already say they would refuse a vaccine, whether because of existing anti-vaccine attitudes or more reasonable concerns about a rushed development process. Those who get the shot are unlikely to be fully protected. The FDA is prepared to approve a vaccine that is at least 50% effective, a level comparable to current flu shots. An imperfect vaccine will still be useful. The risk is that the government goes all in on this one theatrical countermeasure without addressing the systemic problems that made the U.S. so vulnerable, or investing in testing and tracing strategies that will still be necessary. We're still going to need those other things, Dean says. Between these reasons and the time needed for manufacturing and distribution, the pandemic is likely to drag on for months after a vaccine is approved. Already, the event is exacting a psychological toll that's unlike the trauma of a hurricane or a fire. It's not the type of disaster that Americans specifically are used to dealing with, says Samantha Montano of Massachusetts Maritime Academy, who studies disasters. Famines and complex humanitarian crises are closer approximations. Health experts are burning out. Long haulers are struggling to find treatments or support, but many Americans are turning away from the pandemic. People have stopped watching news about it as much or talking to friends about it. I think we're all exhausted. Optimistically, this might mean that people are becoming less anxious and more resilient. More worryingly, it could also mean they're becoming inured to tragedy. The most accurate model to date predicts that the U.S. will head into November with 220,000 confirmed deaths. More than 1,000 healthcare workers have died. One in every 1,125 black Americans has died, along with similarly disproportionate numbers for indigenous people, Pacific Islanders, and Latinos. And yet, a recent poll found that 50% of Republican voters and 33% of independents think the number of deaths is acceptable. In order for us to mobilize around a social problem, we all have to agree that it is a problem, Lori Peek says. It's shocking that we haven't, because you really would have thought that with a pandemic, it would be easy. This is the final and perhaps most costly intuitive error. 9. The habituation of horror. The U.S. might stop treating the pandemic as the emergency that it is. Daily tragedy might become ambient noise. The desire for normality might render the unthinkable normal, like poverty and racism, school shootings and police brutality, mass incarceration and sexual harassment, widespread extinctions and changing climate. COVID-19 might become yet another unacceptable thing that America comes to accept. Whew, well, that does it for the show today. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com, or you can queue up future shows or listen to past shows or re-listen to this show at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.